Chapter 20. It had been a long day for Takeo Yoshida. A crane operator for the Yokohama Port Development Corporation, Yoshida had toiled since 6 in the morning loading an aged Iberian freighter with container after container of Japanese consumer electronics bound for export. He had just secured the last of the metal containers onto the ship's deck when a radio crackled in the crane's control cabin. "Yoshida, this is Takagi," the deep voice of his foreman grumbled. "Report to Dock D5 upon completion with San Sebastian. A single loading for the vessel Baekje. Takagi, out." "Affirmed, Takagi-san," Yoshida answered, holding his disdain under his breath. Just 20 minutes to go on his shift, and Takagi gives him a last-minute assignment across the shipyard. Securing the crane, Yoshida walked 800 yards across the Honmoku port terminal towards Dock D5, cursing Takagi's name with each step he took. As he approached the end of the pier, he glanced beyond at the waters of the bustling port of Yokohama, where a constant stream of commercial ships jockeyed into position for loading and unloading. With 300 meters of waterfront, container terminal D5 was big enough to handle the largest cargo ships afloat. Yoshida was surprised to find the vessel tied to the dock was not the typical jumbo container ship awaiting a load of industrial cargo, but a special-purpose cable ship. Yoshida even recognized the Baekje as having been built in the nearby Mitsubishi Heavy Industries shipyard. At 436 feet long and a beam of 133 feet, the stout vessel was designed to lay fiber-optic cable on the seafloor while withstanding the turbulent seas of the North Pacific. With a modern-appearing superstructure and white paint that still glistened, Yoshida could tell that it had not been many years since the high-tech ship slid into Yokohama Bay for the first time. She sported a Korean flag above the bridge mast and a blue lightning bolt across the funnel, which Yoshida recalled was the signature of a Kang Industries vessel. Short on Korean history, the crane operator did not know that her name, Baekje, represented one of the early Korean tribal kingdoms that dominated the peninsula in the 3rd century AD. A pair of dock workers was securing cables beneath an oblong object on the bed of a large flatbed truck when one of the men turned and greeted Yoshida as he approached. "Hey, Takeo, ever fly a submarine before?" the man yelled. Yoshida returned a confused look before realizing that the object on the back of the truck was a small white submersible. "Takagi says our shift is over once we get it aboard," the man continued, displaying a missing front tooth as he spoke. "Lay it aboard, and let's go get some Sapporos." "Is she secure?" Yoshida asked, waving a hand at the submersible. "Already," the second man replied eagerly, a young kid of 19 who Yoshida knew had just started work on the docks a few weeks before. A few yards away, Yoshida noticed a stocky, bald man with dark eyes surveying the scene near the ship's gangway. A menacing quality lingered over the man, Yoshida thought. He'd been in enough scrapes in the nearby shipyard bars to recognize which men were legitimate tough guys and which were pretenders. This man was no pretender, he judged. Shifting thoughts to the taste of a cold Sapporo beer, Yoshida climbed up a high ladder into the cab of the adjacent container crane and fired up its diesel motor. Adeptly working the levers like a concert pianist tickling the ivories, he expertly adjusted the movable boom and sliding block until satisfied, then dropped the hook and block quickly towards the ground, halting it dead center a few inches above the submersible. The two dock workers quickly slipped a pair of cables over the hoist hook and gave Yoshida the thumbs-up sign. Ever so gently, the crane operator pulled up on the hoist line, the thick cable drawing tight as it wrapped around a drum behind the cab. Slowly, Yoshida raised the 24-ton submersible to a height of 50 feet, hesitating as he waited for its twisting motion to halt before swinging it over to a waiting pad on the Baekje's rear deck. But it never got the chance. Before it could be seen, and almost before it physically started, Yoshida's experienced hands could feel something wrong through the controls. One of the cables had not been properly secured to the submersible, and the tail suddenly slipped down and through a loop in the cable. In an instant, the rear of the sub lunged down, and the white metal capsule hung vertically at a grotesque angle, clinging precariously to the single cable wrapped around its nose. Yoshida didn't breathe, and for a moment it looked like the dangling submersible would stabilize. But before he could move it an inch, a loud twang burst through the air as the lone securing cable snapped. Like a ton of bricks, the submersible dropped straight to the dock below, landing on its tail with an accordion-like smash before plopping over on its side in distress. Yoshida grimaced, already thinking of the grief he would suffer at the hands of Takagi, as well as the reams of insurance paperwork he would be forced to fill out. Thankfully, no one was hurt on the dock. As he climbed down from the crane's cab to inspect the damage, Yoshida glanced at the bald man on the gangway, expecting to see a seething fury. Instead, the mysterious man looked back at him with a cold face of stone. The dark eyes, however, seemed to pierce right through him. The Shinkai three-man submersible was heavily mashed on one end and clearly inoperable. It would be shipped back to its home at the Japanese Marine Science and Technology Center for 3 months' worth of repairs before it would be seaworthy again. The two dock workers did not fare as well. Though not fired, Yoshida noticed that the two men did not show up for work the next day, and in fact were never seen or heard from again. 20 hours later and 250 miles further to the southwest, an American commercial jetliner touched down at Osaka's modern Kansai International Airport and taxied to the international gate. Dirk stretched his 6-foot-4-inch frame as he exited the plane, relieved to be free from the cramped airline seating that only a jockey would find comfortable. Passing quickly through the customs checkpoint, he entered the busy main terminal crowded with businessmen hustling to catch their flights. Stopping briefly, it took just a momentary scan of the terminal before he picked out the woman he was looking for from the mass of humanity. Standing nearly 6 feet tall with shoulder-length flaming red hair, Dirk's fraternal twin sister Summer towered like a beacon in a sea of black-haired Japanese. Her pearl-gray eyes glistened and her soft mouth broke into a grin as she spotted her brother and waved him over to her. "Welcome to Japan," she gushed, giving him a hug. "How was your flight?" "Like riding in a sardine can with wings." "Good. Then you'll feel right at home in the cabin berth I scraped up for you on the Sea Rover," she laughed. "I was afraid you wouldn't be here yet," Dirk remarked as he collected his luggage and they made their way to the parking lot. "When Captain Morgan received word from Rudy that we were to terminate our study of pollutants along the eastern coast of Japan to assist in an emergency search and recovery mission, he wasted no time in responding. Fortunately, we were working not far off Shikoku when we got the call, so we're able to reach Osaka this morning." Like her brother, Summer had possessed a deep love of the sea since childhood. After obtaining a master's degree in oceanography from the Scripps Institute, she'd joined her brother at NUMA following a uniting with their father, who now headed up the undersea organization. As headstrong and resourceful as her sibling, she'd gained respect in the field with her knowledge and hands-on abilities, while her attractive looks never failed to turn heads. Leading Dirk past a row of parked cars, Summer suddenly stopped in front of a tiny orange Suzuki subcompact parked by itself. "Oh no, not another knee crusher," Dirk laughed as he surveyed the tiny vehicle. "A loaner from the Port Authority." "You'll be surprised." After carefully wedging his gear into the minuscule hatchback, Dirk opened the left side door and prepared to pretzel himself into the passenger seat. To his amazement, the interior of the right-hand drive car proved roomy, with a low sitting position creating ample headroom for the 2 6-footers. Summer jumped into the driver's seat and threaded their way out of the parking lot and onto the Hanshin Expressway. Heading north towards downtown Osaka, she accelerated the little Suzuki hard, zipping in and out of traffic for the 12-kilometer drive to the city's port terminal. Exiting the expressway, she turned the car into the Osaka South Port Intermodal Terminal and down a side dock before pulling up in front of the Sea Rover. The NUMA research vessel was a slightly newer and larger version of the Deep Endeavor, complete with matching turquoise paint scheme. Dirk's eyes were drawn to the stern deck, where a bright orange submersible called the Starfish sat glistening like a setting sun. "Welcome aboard, Dirk," boomed the deep voice of Robert Morgan, the master of the Sea Rover. A bearded bear of a man, Morgan resembled a muscular version of Burl Ives. The jovial captain held an amazing array of seagoing experience, having commanded everything from a Mississippi River tugboat to a Saudi Arabian oil tanker. Having salted away a healthy retirement sum from his commercial captain days, Morgan joined Numa for the pure adventure of sailing to unique corners of the globe. Deeply admired by his crew, the skipper of the Sea Rover was a highly organized leader who possessed an acute attention to detail. After storing Dirk's bags, the threesome adjourned to a starboard side conference room, whose porthole windows offered a serene view of Osaka Harbor. They were joined by First Officer Tim Ryan, a lanky man with ice blue eyes. Dirk grabbed a cup of coffee to regain alertness after his long flight, while Morgan got down to business. "Tell us about this urgent search and recovery mission." Gunn was rather vague with the details over the satellite phone. Dirk recapped the Unaska incident and the recovery of the I-403's bomb canister, and what had been learned of the sub's failed mission. When Hiram Yeager reviewed the Japanese naval records in the National Archives, he discovered a near-duplicate operations order that was issued to a second submarine, the I-411. It had the same mission, only to cross the Atlantic and strike New York and Philadelphia instead of the West Coast. "What became of the I-411?" Summer asked. "That's what we're here to find out." Yeager was unable to uncover any definitive information on the I-411's final whereabouts, other than that she failed to appear for a refueling rendezvous near Singapore and was presumed lost in the South China Sea. I contacted St. Julian Perlmutter, who did a step better and found an official Japanese naval inquiry, which placed the loss in the middle of the East China Sea, sometime during the first few weeks of 1945. Perlmutter noted that those facts matched up to a report from the American submarine Swordfish that she had engaged and sunk a large enemy submarine in that region during the same time frame. Unfortunately, the Swordfish was later destroyed on the same mission, so the full accounting was never documented. Their radio report did provide an approximate coordinate of the sinking, however. "So it's up to us to find the I-411, Morgan said matter-of-factly. Dirk nodded. "We need to ensure that the biological bombs were destroyed when the submarine went down, or recover them if they are still intact." Summer stared out one of the porthole windows at a skyscraper in distant downtown Osaka. "Dirk, Rudy Gunn briefed us about the Japanese Red Army. Could they have already recovered the biological weapons from the I-411? "Yes, that's a possibility. Homeland Security and the FBI don't seem to think the JRA has the resources to conduct a deep water salvage operation, and they're probably right. But then all it would take is money, and who's to say how well-funded they or an associate terrorist group may be? Rudy agrees that we better make sure one way or the other." The room fell silent as all minds visualized a cache of deadly biological bombs sitting deep below the ocean's surface, and the consequence if they fell into the wrong hands. "You've got the best ship and crew in Numa at your disposal," Morgan finally said. "We'll get her done." "Captain, we've got a pretty large search area on our hands. How soon can we be underway?" Dirk asked. "We'll need to top off our fuel supplies, plus two or three of the crew are still ashore obtaining additional provisions. I expect we can be underway in 6 hours, Morgan said, glancing at a wall chronometer. "Fine. I'll retrieve the search coordinates and provide them to the ship's navigator right away." As they exited the conference room, Summer tugged at Dirk's elbow. "So what did the data from Perlmutter cost you?" she chided, knowing the gourmet historian's penchant for culinary blackmail. "Nothing much. Just a jar of pickled sea urchins and an 80-year-old bottle of sake." "You found those in Washington, D.C.?" Dirk gave his sister a pleading look of helplessness. "Well," she laughed, "we do have 6 more hours in port."